This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Richard Mao. He is president of Fuller Theological Seminary. I spoke with him on September 8, 2010, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. This interview is included in our program, Restoring Political Civility, an Evangelical View. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Okay, you're ready to go here. And here's your headphones.
Okay.
And here's your volume for the headphones is right here.
Okay. Good.
And they should be there. I guess can we talk to them?
Okay.
Hey, Rich, do you have your headphones on?
Hi, Richard Mao here.
Hi, it's Krista.
Hey, Krista. Good to hear your voice.
You too.
Gee, it's been a long time.
I know. Seems like
you've gotten much more famous since I talked to you last.
I'm totally different, ontologically changed.
Well, you got an ontological...
I've got an ontological name.
Yeah, you're getting into being, gee.
That's right.
And here I've been, I'm all into becoming, and here you're into being. It's just Parmenides versus Heraclitus.
Yeah, and you are going to be one of our first being shows, which I think is great.
Hey, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
What's the, being, as the Catholics would say, is it getting reception?
Well, yeah, it is. It's, it's really interesting. One thing that we heard as we made this decision from people who know about renaming and rebranding is that when you rename anything, you never come out the chute and everybody says, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Right? Because changing something is always stressful, even for people who didn't like the other name. So, I mean, we're getting a lot of reaction. I mean, we've gotten plenty of positive reaction. But it's more, the exercise is more that we have to live into it. And also I think that people just have to hear that it's the same show.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And in fact, as we say, this is a place we've come to. It's what the program has become. Craig Dykstra actually was really helpful for me when I was first talking about this. And he said, I mean, he had his reservations, but he said, I see what you're pointing at is a conversational ethos rather than a topic area.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really helpful because that is what we've done. Speaking of faith is not talking about something that happens for an hour on Sunday, right? Or in particular places. We just talk about how these convictions and questions and ideas and virtues, how they run through everything we do.
Yeah, right.
And so I think people have to see that. But, there is the other interesting thing I'll just tell you, and then obviously I'm going to interview you. But I was at Harvard Divinity School back in the spring, and they were having a really—
Oh, I saw the—I get the bulletin, and I saw
bulletin.
All about that. Yeah.
So they were, one of the discussion we had there was so interesting where these—because that was about the future of progressive Christianity.
Yeah.
And one of the things I ended up saying to them, which— they, to different degrees, already intuitively knew, is that the words that say that progressive Christians, and I mean, I think a lot of religious people use to describe themselves, aren't the shorthand that we think they are, right? And that progressive,
right.
For people who are in that world, it's so meaningful. Even words like justice and peace, right?
Yeah.
They don't carry water. They're controversial in their weird ways.
Yep.
And I think, and I've had this conversation, I've gotten reactions from people like Martin Marty and Craig and, people who feel sad that faith is freighted, but who also get it. And I feel like this is a good and really healthy conversation to have because letting go of the words may mean that we have to communicate much better, right? More vividly.
Exactly.
I said to some people, this is, it's showing, not telling. Which is very much about what you and I are going to talk about.
Yeah.
So I think it's exciting and it's a little scary, but I needed a new challenge. So
yeah,
I got one.
I'm excited for you.
I'm
really
glad.
Am. I've just been so so pleased and proud for what you're doing.
Well,
it's just amazing.
It meant so much to me when you wrote back and just said you would give it your blessing. So
and you got a new book out, huh?
Oh, the Einstein's Guidebook. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've already, that's one, that's like my child that's graduated and gone to college and I don't think about it anymore.
Yeah, I know what that's like.
Yeah, you know, it's been out, it came out in the spring, but it's, that's been fun too.
Yeah,
because that whole, that science religion conversation is another place.
Oh, man, I tell you, it's going to be huge for all of us. I mean, there's so much new stuff going on. I just read this morning a long piece that, from an evangelical school by a theologian saying that the whole genetics thing raises real questions about the idea of an original Garden of Eden. I mean, no matter how you spin that historically, you know, that the continuity of the genetic continuity between non-human and human species and all of that, you know, fang and blood and all that stuff. And, you know, it's fascinating stuff to think about.
But,
and then obviously the technological side of it with, you know, genetic research and the biotech stuff and all the rest. Yeah. The whole range of things is so huge.
I know. Yeah. I really think that science is going to throw out the big theological questions in the 21st century.
Yeah, well, like Hawking already did that.
He did.
With this new thing.
Yeah.
And the way some people are just jumping on that, it's interesting. Yeah. How's your family?
My family's so good. My daughter is 16.
Yeah.
And she's just great. She's, you know, it's so interesting when your children get to be this age that you just learn who they are, right? They have their inner lives and their personalities. And
what's she interested in?
She's artistic. She's at a performing arts high school. She writes songs. She's a real free spirit. She's really different from me, and I have to keep up with how she thinks and how she thinks about her future. But she's just great. She's a really good person.
Has she chosen a college yet?
No, and she's not ambitious, and she, you know, that's a long way away for her.
Two years,
but I say it's not. And she's great. I don't know how she's going to be. I'm going to have to be pushing her in about a year. She's a junior now. She just started. Yeah. So, but she's a really interesting person. My son is 12, and he's incredibly athletic and energetic and all boy.
Gee.
He's playing hockey.
Oh, gosh.
But he's also just a really good person. So I'm having fun with him. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, we need to catch up sometime in person, but I guess we have to.
We sure do. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, Chris, are we okay? All right. So, you know, I'm not going to ask you to tell your story again, though I love it so much. But I've heard it before, and I'll be able to introduce you to people. But I just thought maybe where I'd start is in your childhood. I mean, we've talked about your Christian upbringing in a fundamentalist culture, and you know, in an earlier day of radio preachers. I wonder if you catch your mind back this thing you now call civility. How do you see it in that world you grew up in?
Yeah, right. Well, that's a great question. Well, you know, basically, the kind of evangelical, fundamentalist Christianity that formed me early on had a very strong streak of incivility. You know? We were people that we not only had enemies, but we felt that it was essential to our spiritual identity that we have enemies, you know?
Right, because it was about defining yourselves over against. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this lately in terms of the Pope going to Scotland. you know, the Westminster Confession of the Presbyterian denomination to which I belong. They revised it. They put it all on a footnote. But that Westminster Confession of the Reformation era says that the Pope is the Antichrist.
Yeah.
And I was raised in a world in which it was important to look out for the Antichrist, you know. And I can sort of divide my life up into Antichrist segments, you know. Early on, it was Catholicism. I mean, you know, that number in the Book of Revelation, the number of the beast, 666, people had this wild stuff. Am I going on too long? By the way?
No, no, no. That's good. No. And you know, my grandfather also believed that the Pope was the Antichrist. So
yeah,
I know that.
Well, you know, there was apparently some kind of number on associated with a papal chair or something like that, or some Latin phrase, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And if you assign the appropriate numbers, you would find out that it all added up to 666. You know, and that proved that the Pope was the Antichrist. And then really Vatican II kind of made it more and more difficult. Really into the 50s, you got a very strong anti-communism with Joe McCarthy and the like. And pretty soon it was Stalin, you know.
And, so you're saying the Antichrist has changed across your lifetime.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yep. So, and so we hated communists. And I noticed right around 1980 that it began to shift to Islam.
Hmm. Really? And that early?
And you're getting a lot of, today, you know, overtly anti-Muslim stuff. And it's almost as if we've always got to have somebody that we feel legitimate about really hating. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, intrinsic to the kind of fundamentalist Christianity, with conspiracy theories and antichrists and beasts and all the rest. And so, you know, to all of a sudden start thinking about civility and not allowing yourself to get into that kind of thing has been a kind of a shift for me spiritually.
Right. Now, when you first wrote Uncommon Decency, Christian Civility in an Uncivil World, that was at the end of the 80s, is that right?
Yeah, it was really around 90 that I was writing it, yeah.
So what were you looking at and responding to at that time?
Yeah, well, as I say in the new edition to the book, I was focusing then on the really big struggles in the world. You know, Northern Ireland, Catholic versus Protestant, and the role that religion had.
Right.
So Catholic versus Protestant Northern Ireland, Arab versus Jew in the Middle East, Christian versus Muslim in places like Bosnia-Herzegovina and the like, and the ways in which religion, including the Christian religion, seemed to stoke the fires of hatred and hostility and violence and the like. And so that's really the big stuff that I was thinking about at the time, even though I certainly attended to, you know, some of the more down-to-earth things. But, as I've thought about the revising that book, and people have said to me, you know, you've got to get to the present day where and of course, Northern Ireland is not so much in the news anymore. The Middle East is certainly there, but Eastern Europe is kind of quieted down in terms of Christians and Muslims killing each other there.
Right.
As I've told the story, that within a few weeks after my book came out, I got calls from two major newspapers in the East, independently, two writers working on the whole topic of civility, and they wanted to talk about parking lots and California freeways and rudeness in the aisles of supermarkets. Mm. And I think what we have seen is a gradual domestication of that kind of horrible incivility that we saw on the macro level. And now it's settled in even into the United States Congress. Obviously stimulated and reinforced a lot by 24/7 cable news, where they almost seem to survive on a lot of incivility. I mean,
You know, you quote a couple of lines of Yeats, which maybe this is a kind of an extreme version, but it certainly is a way that looking at this issue of incivility. The lines are, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity."
Yeah.
And then you take a phrase that Martin Marty coined, that what we need is convicted civility.
Yeah.
That's really a thesis that you've carried forward and developed. So I want to know what you mean by convicted civility.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think if, as somebody who's been working at a lot of issues of Christianity and culture and Christian engagement with the larger world, that's a phrase that, even though I got it from Martin Marty, it's sort of become a part of my branding. You
right,
know,
right.
People attribute it to me.
Yes.
But the larger context there was that Marty said, you know, and this is a book he wrote back in the 80s or so. He said, a lot of people today who have strong convictions are not very civil. And a lot of people who are civil don't have very strong convictions.
Right.
And what we really need is convicted civility. And it's that, you know, how do we look at people with whom we have real disagreements, serious disagreements, and at the same time treat them, you know, the biblical term, there are two wonderful terms there in the Bible. In the Old Testament, Jeremiah says, seek the shalom, the welfare, it's usually translated, but seek the shalom of the city in which you are, God has placed you.
Mm.
And because in its shalom, you will find your shalom. And how do we look at what was in that context, you know, Hebrew people in exile, trying to figure out how in the world they're going to relate to a pagan culture. And then God says, seek their shalom, seek their well-being. And, you know, even if you disagree radically with them. And then in the New Testament, the Apostle Peter says that we have to honor all human beings and have a regard for their well-being. And I take those to be sort of different ways of getting at a very common biblical theme. What does it mean for me to honor the Muslim, to honor the Mormon, to honor people of unbelief who are hostile toward Christianity? What does it mean to honor them? And then I think we need to work at the theology there. You know, how do we view other people?
So, you know, I want to just test something out on you that I've thought about a lot over the years, that as American culture started to become genuinely pluralistic around the 1960s. The virtue that was put forward, the civic virtue we started to learn and educate into our children, was the virtue of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that for religious people, for all kinds of religious people, tolerance is not nearly a big enough word.
No, it's not.
It's a cerebral word. I mean, to me, it doesn't stretch to compassion, to honoring, you know,
right.
As you just said.
That's
and
right.
So I've wondered if we, you know, what that we have to, we've lived now a few decades. I mean, it's a pretty short period of time. And of course, now globalization has happened. So it's all opened up. But that we really are now at the beginning of learning what those virtues are that we need for our common life. And that maybe, in fact, religious people, right, theology should have a very rich role to play in that.
Ah, that's really great. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I think the tolerance, toleration, you know, you say, well, you know, my neighbor next door practices her tuba every day for 2 hours and I get sick of it, but I tolerate it. You
right.
Know? Well, tolerate there is just means you don't tell her how angry you are.
Right, and the medical term tolerance is like how much can you take before you get sick or you have a bad
reaction, right.
Which is
exactly
actually the
right.
way it's functioned.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But what I've tried to do with civility, and it really gets to, it's a part of, it has to do with the virtues. I'm glad you used that term because, you know, to be civil, it comes from civitas, and it means learning how to live in the city. And
back to
you know,
that
the
Jeremiah
origin,
image.
Yeah, the origin with a guy like Aristotle, the ancient philosopher, who said, you know, we early on, as little children, we have a natural sense of kinship. We have strong positive feelings toward those who are blood relatives, our mother, my father, sisters and brothers, cousins and the like. And then as we grow up, we have some of those same positive feelings that develop toward friends. And so we go from kinship and we build on that to a broader sense of friendship where you have that same sense of bonding or something like it. that isn't just based on blood relative stuff. But he said to really grow up, to be a mature human being, is to learn in the public square to have that same sense of bonding to people from other cities, people who are very different than yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's not just toleration, but it's a sense that what I owe to my mother because she brought me into this world, what I owe to my friends because of shared experiences and memories and delights, I also owe to the stranger. And that's more than toleration. It's extending the kinship, friendship thing even further to other people. Why? Because they're human like me. And I've got to begin to think of humanness as such, as a kind of bonding relationship.
So what you just said is so powerful. And then at the same time, I'm not telling you anything new. I mean, you are an evangelical educator, philosopher, leader. And you also know that evangelical Christians and other, some other forms of Christianity have been very closely associated with incivility in recent years, especially in American political life. Now, it's not the whole story of evangelical Christianity or Christianity, but that association is undeniable. So partly what I want to do is I want to try to get your sense of the big picture here. So not just what the connection is, but take that apart a little bit, you know? Here's what I want to ask you. So I would say right now, as you and I are speaking, a lot of Americans may have the sense from these last few decades that there are some really vitriolic and damaging religious sentiments and voices that have become very vocal in our public life. Now, and I want to know what you think this does and doesn't have to do with the evolution of evangelical Christianity in public life. So, you know, we've talked about this a lot on this program in the last few years. In the early 20th century, in fact, it was the people we would today call evangelical Christians who pretty much withdrew from public life and said, we will care about private morality and personal salvation. At the end of the 20th century, evangelical Christians reemerged in public life and in electoral political life. President Bush was in office for 8 years at the beginning, which was maybe the apex of that development. And then I think a lot of people felt like evangelicals got pretty quiet in the last couple of years. And then there is this surge of, I don't know, Tea Party, Glenn Beck, anti-Islamic sentiment that often has religious overtones. And so I just want to ask you, is this a new, from your vantage point, is this a new stage in the life of evangelical Christianity in the U.S.? Or, you know, how would you describe this as part of the big picture?
Yeah, thanks. Now, see, I think that evangelicalism constantly goes back and forth, not only from between sort of alienation from the culture to a kind of takeover mentality, but back and forth between two sort of theologies that bear on that. All of those decades in the 20th century when evangelicals said, you know, this world is not our home. We're bound for heaven, and our main job is to get other individuals saved so that they can go to heaven with us. And to try to change society is like trying to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. I mean, this is a sinking ship. There was that was undergirded by an apocalyptic theology, a theology that the world is getting worse and worse.
And also that was the early 20th century. You had world wars. You had global economic depression, right? I mean, there were reasons to look around and say that.
Yeah, but also a tremendous sense of loss. I mean, evangelicalism in the 19th century, for a good part of the 19th century, was the American religion, Oh, beauty, you know, God bless America, oh, beautiful for sacred dreams and all this stuff. But as George Marsden, the historian, pointed out, that going from the 19th to the 20th century for many evangelicals was like an immigration experience. They'd gone into a it was a spiritual immigration. Suddenly they looked around and said, they've taken away my nation and I do not know where they have laid it, you know. And it was suddenly a strange country that we were in. We no longer felt at home here. But something happened around 1980, and, you know, you can go back and look at Anita Bryant and Jerry Falwell and all that.
Moral
something
Majority,
happened around.
Christian
yeah.
Coalition.
And that was right there, you know, the very interesting thing. For 80 years, they had seen themselves as a moral minority on the edges of culture, waiting for the whole thing to blow up. And suddenly, in 1980, they announced that they are the moral majority. I mean, what went on there? And I think, for one thing, there was a class shift. My wife and I were traveling across the country one time, and somebody asked Phyllis to take pictures of churches along the way for a kind of dictionary of American Christianity. And so we'd be going across Highway 80 in Nebraska, and we'd get off the road and go into this little town, and typically it went like this, that the Presbyterian and Methodist Episcopal churches were at the center of town. And then over across the tracks, there was a Pentecostal, a little kind of shack-type church, yeah. You know, or a Nazarene church. Well, today, those churches own the best real estate in town.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And
they have brand new big buildings.
Yeah, and, uh-huh. and they are the mega churches. And we've seen this tremendous decline of mainline Protestantism. And so evangelicals suddenly around 1980 were feeling a new leverage, a new cultural power. And they were very upset about the sexual revolution and what that was doing to what their children were being taught in schools and what they were seeing on local magazine rack displays in the local grocery store and all the rest. And they suddenly decided, we're going to take this country back.
Right.
And then there was a lot of disillusionment with that. You know, Falwell died and Pat Robertson made some really strange pronouncements. And there was a lot of embarrassment with Ted Haggard and others. And there was a kind of quieting. But somehow, you know, the Glenn Beck phenomenon and some other things have... And the anti-Islam stuff has revived that sense that they're taking something away from us and we got to get it back. And especially the shift from the Bush administration to the Obama administration seems to have had a lot to do with that.
And Glenn Beck, of course, is Mormon, but he sounds like an evangelical.
I know. Richard Land, who
Southern Baptist, yeah.
Yeah, he isn't usually very, very generous with theological or spiritual assessments of people who aren't Southern Baptists. Said that he heard Glenn Beck at the Washington rally and came away with the impression that he had sounded a lot like Billy Graham, you know, which is really quite a compliment.
Yeah. So I think one element here that feels very dramatic and troubling to a lot of people watching this is it's not just conviction, right? And it's not just, as you say, there were people who emerged and they had a big constituency saying there are issues we care about and we're going to, and they were in fact very smart with the electoral in electoral politics in mobilizing and galvanizing.
Yeah.
But there's a sense in which the issues that are being taken up now and the spirit in which they're being taken up now plays fast and loose with the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, and
how do you see that? And you're an evangelical Christian. I mean, what is that?
Well, I mean, you know, you're getting at something that I'm just really deeply disturbed about with evangelical Christians, and I'll give you an example that I use in the revised, expanded version of my book. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to this guy talk about Mormonism, and he says all kinds of things about Mormons, that 12 years of rather extensive dialogue with Mormon scholars and Mormon leaders, I just know those things aren't true, or they're not They're not accurate. And so I went up to him afterward and I said, you know, yeah, some things right, but, you know, there are some other things that you really need to take another look at Mormonism. And he said, oh, you know, intellectuals, you're always trying to make all these distinctions. Our job is to battle for the truth, and we don't have time.
Right.
We're all these niceties, you know. And here's the thing. He's talking about battling for the truth and willing to tell untruths in the battle for truth, which is the strangest thing. And what this really gets at, Krista, is that for Christians who take the Bible seriously, it isn't that we have these convictions and then we also got to try to be civil. But the truth element of civility is itself one of the convictions. You know, I mean, if our conviction, if our repertoire of convictions includes this, that God tells us we must not bear false witness against our neighbors, then how can we be so fast and easy with and loose with telling the truth about others, making these blanket statements about Muslims? I mean, you and I know Muslims who do not fit any of the stereotypical caricaturing kind of claims that are being used these days.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people think nothing of just saying, you know, the Quran is an evil book and anybody who's devoted to the Quran is just an evil person.
They're writing off a billion people. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and you know, so another example of something that's come up is the civil rights, right? The civil rights movement. I mean, and that's history that you were part of. And there were lots of Christians, white Christians, as well as black Christians, who were right in the middle of that movement. And then there's this Christian-tinged kind of rewriting of it. You know, taking it back when in fact Christianity was right at the center of it, including evangelicalism.
Right.
You were there.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of very frustrating confusions and distortions in all of that, because we Christians, and especially evangelical Christians, one of the great blots on our record is that we really did not get with the civil rights struggle in any serious way on the whole. I mean, there were some who did. And suddenly to be righteously claiming that and then identifying some of the new things that people are concerned about with carrying on of the civil rights struggle is just a lot of hypocrisy there. Yeah.
So, you know, I do want to name the fact that you write very seriously about the potential downside to civility, or civility superficially imagined, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it relativism is not relativism or some kind of superficial idea of accepting and affirming everything. That's not where you want to go with this. That's not where you think it's good for us, even as a culture, to go, even when we hold different views about the territory we're navigating.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how you think, where does the example of Jesus come in? I mean, how do you think of Jesus in terms of avoiding relativism while being civil, while being there for others? How do you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I do think that Jesus is a model of civility, of convicted civility. I mean, the murmuring against him that we read about in the gospel accounts is that this is a person who associates with harlots and with corrupt tax collectors and, you know, other quote-unquote sinners in the culture. And yet it's very clear that Jesus did not approve of prostitution or of compliance with the economic practices of the Roman Empire, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a clear case where Jesus reached out to people, but in none of that was he sacrificing convictions about what is right, what is good, what is true. I mean, some of his harshest judgments were for people who were very condemnatory toward other people and not aware of their own sin, not aware of their own shortcomings. You
right.
know? So he wasn't afraid to call Pharisees, whited sepulchres, which was quite an insult. Yeah.
Right. In some of your, I want to talk as we move forward about some of the descriptions and prescriptions you have in your book for a gentler Christianity. And one of them is, for starters, concentrate on your own sinfulness and the other person's humanness.
Yeah, yeah. You know, actually, I get that from John Calvin, who probably a lot of people, if they know anything about the great 16th century reformer, or have at least heard about something about Calvinism. Do not think of Calvin or Calvinism as a model of civility. But, Calvin said that a political leader who's thinking about going to war, and he was not a pacifist, and so he would say, sometimes we do need to go to war. But before we go to war, he said, we need to go through two exercises. And the one is to test out our own motives, to make sure that we're not being carried away by some evil motive in ourselves, like just a desire to grab land or an uncontrollable anger or spirit of vengeance. And then he says, and we also have to reflect on the humanity of the other person. And what I've taken out of that is that Calvin is saying, when a George Bush or President Obama thinks about going to war, they ought to, first of all, test their own motives, and secondly, they ought to think about the humanity of the people against whom they're going to be waging warfare. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of what I call a hermeneutic of suspicion toward yourself and charity toward others. Hmm. And it may very well be that after you've spent all that time thinking about Saddam Hussein and thinking about your own motives, that you do decide that you should go to war. Certainly in the case of a Hitler and others, I think we can understand that. But a lot of unjust wars or unwise military operations could be avoided if we took that kind of advice. And I think that's true of our relationship with just other people
right.
as well.
Because it feels like when we talk about the culture war these last years, and that's not a bad analogy. And here's something that feels important to me to name, that this process of self-examination that you're talking about, We have a culture of fear, right? I mean, and if you watch these rallies and you hear what people say, and if you look behind the kind of, even if you try to look behind the human, I don't want to use the word, the kind of distorted urgency that's behind, something like burning Qurans. What you see is this fearfulness, right?
Yeah.
And we know that when human beings, as creatures, we know this from brain science now, that when we're acting out of fear, people are not probably capable of asking those self-aware questions that you just posed, even if they are deeply religious and believe themselves mm-hmm. to be acting mm-hmm. in a Christian way. So how do Christian leaders like you and people at Fuller Seminary, how does theology respond both to, maybe to that fear in order to make that other kind of self-awareness possible?
Yeah. That's interesting because I've been talking to some of my friends about, some of this stuff recently. And I've got to say to you, Chris, that, when I talk to people who really like Glenn Beck, and in my part of the world, I run into a lot of folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to be honest with you and say, one thing I can say to them is, some of the things he's concerned about, I'm concerned about too.
Yeah.
I do worry about what's happening in our culture. I do worry about the ongoing, I think, very bad effects of the sexual revolution, about a lot of the stuff that we see on television and in film. And in the kinds of things that are shaping our young people in music and other forms of culture. So I worry about that stuff, and I do worry about it. Anything goes, you know. All religions are of equal value, and all the rest. So, and I think it's important to not just to say to people, "Oh, you're all wrong, and you shouldn't be carried away like that," but to say, "I share a lot of those concerns, mm-hmm. and what are we going to do about that?" And we have to be very careful that we not sin in the process of expressing and acting upon those concerns. And so, you know, I'm pretty conservative about a lot of these issues. And I think it's very important for a leader to approach people who are having a hard time controlling their fears. First of all, to identify, to the degree that we can with integrity, to identify with those fears. And, I mean, it's sort of what you know, all of us who've been through therapy and all the rest, you know, the therapist doesn't say, well, that's a stupid way to feel.
Right. You know? Tell somebody who's afraid how stupid they are and you back them into a corner. And I feel like that's one of the dynamics of our political life now, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of this incivility.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's important for us to empathetically approach the people that we're trying to influence and trying to serve, and try to point up to a better way of dealing with those issues, and at the same time, a more truthful assessment of the issues, because it's so easy when you're afraid to kind of create an enemy that may not be the enemy that you think the person is.
So I guess I'm curious, is there, you know, what gets onto the radar, what makes it into the news are the very extreme moments and the extreme strident statements and the little church in Florida that's burning Qurans.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, though, are there discussions happening in the larger universe of evangelicalism and charismatic Christianity, which is also represented at Fuller? I mean, you have a lot of denominations at Fuller, and you have a conservative liberal span as well. So is there soul-searching, is there leadership of the kind you talked about happening that's not making the news, that the outside world is not privy to?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I'm experiencing with the younger generation of students at Fuller, and I also, you know, travel to a lot of evangelical college campuses, is that there's a younger generation coming up right now that is embarrassed by the image of evangelicalism as an intolerant, mean-spirited. There have even been some Barna surveys that have put some numbers on this, you know, that they're younger people. And if you take something like sexuality, for example, and all the debates over same-sex relations, I mean, a lot of younger evangelicals who may very well agree with the basic theology and the kind of understanding of biblical teaching that many of us have, you know, they got sisters who are lesbians, though. Mm-hmm. They went to high school with kids who came out of the closet. And they just see this in much more relational terms. And the blanket, angry, judgmental caricaturing of the gay, lesbian community just doesn't fit their sense of who these folks are. And it doesn't mean that there are different convictions, but it does mean that they interpret the overall reality in very different terms. And so I think there's a good dialogue going on in the younger generation of people who are wanting to think differently, and especially when we have an opportunity in classrooms, at colleges and seminaries, to kind of sit back and talk about these things. I mean, there's something wonderful about the gift of leisure in higher education, that we can actually sit back in a classroom, have people read things, expose them to different points of view, and then really try to work through what a sensible assessment of all of us really comes to.
And then I suppose you are training people who are going to be out and in churches, I mean, who yep. will take that, the yep. the fruits of that leisure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, we can learn a lot from the past. I mean, you know, you and I both knew a world, an American culture that was very racist, very segregated. You don't have as strong memories of that as I do, but it was really there. And a lot of our friends and loved ones, you know, we were in the among the sort of in the intellectual community where we were socialized to be sensitive to this kind of thing. And then we'd go home to family and friends, and they didn't quite get it, many of them. And yet today there are significant changes in attitudes within those subcultures. And I think a lot of it had to do with patient people in pulpits and in teaching roles and other kinds of leadership positions who were willing to not just angrily denounce, but try to tell the stories and probe some of the spiritual concerns that were at stake. And I think we need to be doing that today on many of the things you and I are talking about here.
One of the things you talk about in your book on civility, Uncommon Decency, is about serving a slow God. Tell me what. So I think that's, you know, pull it on in terms of what you just said. What, talk to me about that relationship with civility.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really has. It's really a way of getting at the issue of patience. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's a tendency to want to solve this thing, and indeed to identify an enemy and think that we can go into battle and just wipe the enemy out is a manifestation of a kind of impatience. And I think the that idea of a slow God came to me when we were talking with a group of evangelicals. We're talking with a couple of Catholic friends at a conference that we're at, and kind of over dinner. And we're talking about some of the issues that were plaguing the evangelical community. And one of my Catholic colleagues said, don't they realize that God works slowly? And you know, Catholicism
works slowly.
Has a much more, it works very slowly.
It has a long sense of time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of thing that we need more of. Just anybody who takes the Bible seriously needs to realize that, you know, we can't rush God's purposes. We can't bring an end to history before God is willing to do so. We can't end injustice. What God calls us to do and to be is not to change the world, but to be faithful in a vision that, be faithful in setting forth a vision of life that opposes error and opposes injustice and all the rest, but realizing that you know, we're not messiahs, and God isn't going to hold us responsible for righting all the wrongs in the world.
I'd like to, in that spirit, I'd like to ask you, you know, kind of made a list of some descriptions and prescriptions that you have, and I'd like to just ask you about the biblical and theological underpinnings of these. So, following on what you just said, you wrote, God has a gentle and reverent concern for public righteousness. So tell me where you see that. How do you know that?
Yeah. Well, I can go write the Bible verses. You know, in 1 Peter, the first epistle of the Apostle Peter, a verse that gets used all the time among evangelicals. Be ready at any time. To give a reason for the hope that lies within you of anyone who asks it of you, you know. And we've always said that, you know, we've always got to be making the case. We've always got to be defending our beliefs against people who disagree with us. But we saw them go on and quote the next part of that verse, which is, and do so with gentleness and reverence. You know? I've often thought how different our theological and even our interreligious disagreements would get played out if we constantly said to ourselves, I've got to treat the other person with gentleness and reverence. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, I've experienced this in my own relations over the last decade or so with the Mormon community. You know, I'm not a generalist when it comes to other religions, but the three religions that I take very seriously for dialogue are Judaism, Islam, and Mormonism. Mm. And those are ones that I've chosen to concentrate on. But they all have to do with either groups that left us or that we left, you know. And Christianity broke with Judaism, and it separated, stood over against, and with Islam. And then Mormonism kind of departed from us. And, right. And in each case, often with very angry relations on both sides. I mean, hostile relations on both sides. And so in the case of the Mormon community, I just decided that I was going to listen. I was going to ask them, what do you really believe? You know, and to try to get at an understanding of Mormonism, which, you know, I have real disagreements with a lot of things in it. But I wanted to be sure that what I was disagreeing with was really what they believed. And there's been a tendency in dealing with other religions, and especially those that we're competing with, as we are with Mormonism, you know. Mm.
Globally.
Evangelical. Yeah, we're all competing for converts and all this kind of thing.
Right.
That instead of telling Mormons what they believe, that we ask them what they believe. And it's been a wonderful experience for me to realize that some of the things that I attributed to Mormonism just aren't there. And that's really helped me to get at a better sense of where the real differences are. And I don't want to get into all of that here. But I do think a gentle and reverent approach to people with whom we disagree is simply going to them and making sure that we understand them. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell this story of being in a parking lot. This is after I wrote the original version of my book. And I saw a parking space in this mini mall, and I had to go into a grocery store. So I pulled into the parking space, and I heard somebody honking. And this woman, she was in a car, and it was obvious that she had been waiting for that space. I hadn't seen her. And she gave me the finger and, you know, angry gestures and went on. And I got out of the car, and I thought, I'm going to find her. So I went and looked, and sure enough, I found her parking in a more distant place in the lot. And as she got out of the car, I just went up to her, and I said, you know, I took a parking place that you were waiting for, and I didn't realize it. And I just want to tell you, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I don't blame you for being angry with me. And she started to cry. And she said, you don't know what kind of day I've had. And she just stormed away. Mm. And then after a little while, just a few steps, she turned around with tears streaming down her face. And she said, thank you, in a very gentle tone, you know. And I thought, you know, I don't usually react that way, but that was a case, and I don't mean to make myself look like this wonderful person, but that was a case where I responded to somebody's anger with a gentleness and a reverence, and it paid off for me.
Mm-hmm. And it paid off for her. I mean,
yeah. And I just think that, you know, you can go through the biblical teaching and find all sorts of ways in which we, you know, G.K. Chesterton once said, you know, it's bad to have false gods, but it's also bad to have false devils, you know, and to demonize another person without being sure that they really are worthy of demonization is a terrible thing.
So, you know, and again, I think a view of evangelicals that's come through, especially in American political life in recent years, has been about who they are, who and what they are opposed to, who they disagree with, right? But so here's another statement from you about just an essential Christian truth, which is, in affirming the stranger, we are honoring the image of God.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I mean, going back to that Aristotle idea that, we all understand kinship and then we understand friendship. But then there's this person who is neither kin nor friend, but we have encountered them. And what is it that links me to them if it isn't just a lot of good feelings that I have about people like that? And what the Bible teaches is that every human being is created in a divine image. And that this means that every human being is a, and this is where I've been thinking more about this lately, is a work of art. Seeing other people is a kind of exercise in art appreciation,
Okay.
And I have this wonderful story from St. Teresa of Lisieux, who, is this young nun who now greatly admired in Catholic circles. But she was in a convent for less than a decade before she died. But she wrote this wonderful journal, spiritual journal. And she was very much in love with Jesus and would talk to Jesus in very intimate terms. And at one point she says, "Jesus, there's this other nun in the convent. I can't stand her. And I know the devil must be at work in me on that. So I realize that you created her. She's a work of art that you created. And I know every artist likes to have her handiwork appreciated. And so I've tried to look at her as your work of art and try to appreciate the intentions of the artist, And I find that very powerful, that I come across a person who isn't just a stranger, but maybe represents a strangeness to me that initially I might feel very alienated from that person. And then to think, this is a work of art by the God whom I worship. That God created that person. And it's something like art appreciation. It doesn't come easy. I'm kind of aesthetically deprived, and so I have to work at it. But it's a very important exercise to engage in.
You have been very clear and open across the years, for example, about your theological opposition to gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine that someone who is homosexual might hear what you just said and feel that, in fact, it's, that doesn't find expression when you look at them, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it should. I can't say that I'm always proud of the attitudes that I have, but, what are my stories about my own learnings in the area of civility was going to a gay mass one night at a large Episcopal church. And I went as a kind of observer. I wanted to see what this thing was all about. And they were advertising that they were having a gay mass. And when I got there, the place was just packed. And I had thought I could sit in the back and kind of watch it and take notes as a reporter. And instead, I had to go and sit toward the front in the middle of this congregation. And two powerful things happened to me that evening. And the one was that they did Psalm 139 in unison at a certain point in the liturgy. And Psalm 139, this particular passage says, when I was in my mother's womb, you knit me together. You know my intimate parts, And before I was even born, you knew who I was. And I started to cry. I mean, that I was surrounded by people, very different lifestyles, very different beliefs about right and wrong on certain key issues. But every one of them, God had knit together when they were in their mother's womb. And then there came a point where they had the prayers for the dead. And the priest asked that people speak out a name of someone who had died of AIDS. And it was thunderous. I mean, Mabel. Kevin, I mean, just one after another. And I realized I was surrounded by a tremendous grieving community who had been deeply, deeply wounded by the AIDS crisis. And it was a powerful experience for me. Now, did I come away changing my overall theological views? No. But ever since then, I have really tried to emphasize the fact that that even in expressing our disagreements, and this is a very complicated thing, but that we're dealing with people who are precious works of divine art, and that we can't dehumanize them, we can't demonize them, and we really need to begin. And this is why, you know, I have argued on a number of occasions and actually gotten some very positive response from folks in the gay lesbian community that maybe I even wrote a Newsweek piece on this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
You know, maybe it's time to stop yelling at each other and accusing each other in public. And maybe we ought to just sit down and turn the agenda into something like this, where I would ask my gay and lesbian activist friends, what is it about people like me that scare you so much? And that you in turn would listen to me when I say, what is it about what you are advocating that worries me so much about the future of our culture and the world in which my grandchildren are being raised? And that we talk about hopes and fears rather than angrily denouncing each other as homophobes or as people who are engaged in, you know, despicable behavior. But we just talk about our hopes and fears. Could that shape a very different kind of discussion as we move toward the really important question is how are we going to be able to live together in this pluralistic society?
Right.
With at least some better understanding of what motivates us beneath the angry denunciations and things.
You know, I just want to read a bit of that piece you wrote in Newsweek, which you just summarized. But this was in Newsweek in January of 2009, and it was around the Prop 8 controversy. And California, where you're based, continues to be this very fraught place with over the issue of gay marriage, with judgments and counter-judgments and laws and counter-laws. So here's one of the things you wrote. You wrote, "Can we talk? This is a plea to your fellow citizens on both sides of this divide over sexuality. Can we talk? I ask this as someone who has been one of the angry ones, angry about things that have been said about people like me. I've been on talk shows where people phone in to call me a fascist or equate me with those who burned accused witches at the stake. One remark that hit especially close to home was made by the editor of this magazine, Newsweek. He wrote that anyone who tries to make a scriptural case against same-sex marriage is guilty of, quote, the worst kind of fundamentalism, unquote. That hurt. I have spent several decades of my life trying to spell out an evangelical alternative to the worst kind of fundamentalism. My friends and I have argued that the Bible supports racial justice, gender equality, peacemaking, and care for the environment, views that often draw the ire of the worst kind of fundamentalists. But none of that seems to matter to folks who don't like our views about same-sex relations." And then you did end with this plea for people. You said you want to hear from people who worry about your views. Why are you frightening? What do you need to hear from us that would reduce your anxiety? What is your vision of a flourishing pluralistic society? So tell me, did people come back to you? Did you get that?
Yeah.
Did that talking start?
Yeah, I got hundreds of responses, some letters, a lot of emails, a couple of angry phone calls. They divided into three groups. One was just some other Christian folks who happened to disagree, who happened to agree with me, there are actually a few of them, but, you know, people saying thank you for saying what you did. I got some very let me just say, the vast majority was angry stuff, and again, people who just repeated it. I mean, I got stuff, opening lines that I can't repeat on family radio, certainly. there was a lot of stuff of, you know, you're just a fascist kind of a person, and as bad as those who, you know, bought and sold slaves and all the rest. But I got some wonderfully poignant people who said, okay, you've asked for it. Let me tell you my experience. You know, I was raised in a Southern Baptist home, and at a certain point I realized that I was a lesbian. and the cruelty that they had experienced. It was very gratifying that some people really took me up on it. And, unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to respond because I really did get hundreds of responses.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that experience of going through that, of writing this piece, of the responses you got, and everything else, you have been out there talking about civility for a long time, and you're out there talking about it again. I mean, do you get hopeful, or do you feel more despairing?
The part of it, Krista, is just that there are a lot of crazies out there. I mean, it's amazing when you write something like that, the venom that you experience, and people who really did not attend to what you were really saying.
Yeah.
You know, they get triggers certain things and they just go off. But I tend to take that, yeah, that's going to happen, take that for granted. But I'm gratified by, a growing, minority segment of the Christian subculture. On the more conservative side of the spectrum of people who are really willing to think some new thoughts about how we deal with people, how we relate to people with whom we disagree. And I think some of it has to do with just the telling of stories. I spoke to a group of more conservative people in a mainline denomination, and we were, they know that I'm on the same side they are in terms of ordination questions and performing of same-sex civil unions and marriages and the like. And this couple came up to me afterward and thanked me, and what's happening to our denomination and the like. And I finally just felt I had to say something to them, and I said, at the same time, we need to deal with this in new ways. I mean, there are just a lot of folks out there who are really being hurt by the angrier things. And all of a sudden, she started to cry. And they looked at each other, and it was like they gave each other permission. And then they said to me, our son is gay. And recently he came home with his partner, and we just decided that we want to stay related to our son. And that meant that we had to accept the two of them into our home. And they actually agreed to go to church with us on Sunday. And at the end of the service, they said, we're glad we were with you today. And they said, we realized that we need to think some new thoughts and do some new things on this. And I think so much of this is probing beneath the surface of some of the rhetoric and getting at some of the hopes and fears.
Mm-hmm. Probing beneath what captures the headlines. And
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people out there right now who are just trying to figure out how they're going to deal with this pastorally, in family relations, friendships. And it's not enough just to be standing on street corners holding up angry signs. It's not enough. It's even wrong to be standing on street corners and holding up angry signs. Nor is it very helpful when people who disagree with way more conservative types simply constantly yell at us that we're homophobes and fascists.
One thing you wrote is being civil isn't just trying to be respectful toward the people we know. It is also to care about our common life. And, that might seem like a really simple sentence, but those words, our common life, which you italicize, jump out at me. Because that phrase has almost become foreign in American cultural discourse.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it amazing? I mean, my Catholic scholar friends, some of them have written on the whole idea of the common good,
Mm-hmm.
And it's a biblical idea. I mean, going back to that Jeremiah passage, seek the welfare, the shalom of the city in which I've placed you. And we ought to be. And then when we think of a common life, that the fact that our kids are going to school together, that We are in the same parking lots. We are in the same supermarket aisles. We're driving the same freeways. We're attending the same churches and synagogues and mosques and all the rest. And that there's a common life that, and it's not just a political bond, but that beneath all of that, there's something that binds human beings together that politics can't create and it shouldn't be able to destroy. And that we really need to be thinking as people of faith, how is it that our common life can flourish? And even if it isn't going to be perfect and it isn't going to fit all of our convictions, how can we have a flourishing common life together?
So,
we live in Pasadena, or Fuller Seminary is in Pasadena, California, and every year we go take a group of guests to the Rose Parade. And that's such an inspiring experience. I'm not a parade person that much, but
what kind of surprise to hear you say that? Yeah.
but the spirit of the crowd, people have, some of them have been there all night, and just the goodwill and the I don't know, it's just a marvelous thing, and you get a sense there of a common life, of a civic culture that we ought to want that to flourish.
And here's, I think, one of the things that's come to concern me as much as anything else is in these examples of incivility, that these specters of incivility that have emerged in these last couple of years, is that there is such an abyss of knowing, of relationship or communication between the people who believe one thing and the people who believe the other, right? Whether it's about who Barack Obama is, to who Muslims are, to same-sex marriage. It's almost like we more and more inhabit parallel universes. And which makes that common life feel more out of reach. I mean, you know, something that grabbed me as reading your blog, and somebody who had responded to something you wrote about Glenn Beck. And here's what he said. I listen regularly to Beck, 5 to 8 hours a week, because he is the most dangerous man in America right now, even though I agree with 80% of what he says. That's how deception works. He says it ain't deception if it ain't seductive. But most people who disagree with Glenn Beck are not listening to anything he says, right?
No, so, that's right.
I mean,
I
wonder what you can tell all the rest of us from this place you inhabit, where you have somebody who considers Glenn Beck to be the most dangerous person in the world, and it agrees with 80% of what he says. So is there navigation that's going on that the rest of us can't see if you just have this kind of have this macro or journalistic view of our division?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Krista, I don't want to answer the wrong question. I'm not quite sure what you're asking me.
A common life, the fact that feels more and more out of reach because, even if people weren't, that we weren't good at debating things or resolving them 10 years ago, it feels like there's less of a shared reality.
Yeah.
On these really hard things and really essential things that we have to talk about, like the definition of marriage or how do we inhabit the world with Muslims, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder if you have any perspective that might bridge some of that from a place like Fuller, where in fact you do have people who span some of these big gaps.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I have the privilege of being involved in the largest graduate theological school in the world. And we have people from 60, 70 nations at any given time and many different denominations bound together by an evangelical faith. But for all of that, a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the blessings of that is that we learn to live with at least a certain kind of diversity within the evangelical world. And I think more and more we're committed to bringing people in. We're doing rabbi dialogues, evangelical Jewish dialogues. We're bringing Mormon scholars onto campus for dialogue. We're have common projects with Muslims and others. And I think it's so important to create these kinds of spaces. My good friend Bob Millett, who you've had on, who's a leading Mormon scholar from Brigham Young, when we first started our dialogues, I had him come and speak to our board of trustees at Fuller Seminary because they were wondering, what's Mao into, you know, into this Mormon dialogue kind of thing. And Bob Millett said this. He said, you know, we Mormons have been basically out of contact with historic Christianity for 150 years. We're not even sure that we're using the right terminology. And he said, we're not trying to convert anybody at Fuller. You know, what we want is a safe place to ask questions and to try to clarify things. And more and more that idea of a safe place, I find that's what I'm talking about, say, with my gay and lesbian friends, with whom, you know, I may disagree about a lot of things, but can we find a place to talk together that's a safe place where we don't have to yell at each other. We don't have to worry about who's going to write this up or televise this, but that we can just talk together about the hopes and fears. I keep going back to that because I love that line in the Christmas Carol, you know, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. And I think that's a fundamental spiritual reality that what the gospel is all about is addressing and bringing healing to our deepest hopes and fears. And I'm convinced that focusing on hopes and fears is an important part of it, but we need safe places. And the problem is there aren't safe places anymore today. People in Congress have told me, you know, the locker room, the coat room used to be the safe place, you know, where a Republican and a Democratic senator could say, you know, you made that speech out there, but let's talk about it here. And they would come out of the coat room with some kind of better understanding of each other. And now it's as if they can't talk to each other in any kind of safe place. And so it's all public rhetorical exchanges that where they're accountable to a constituency that's going to read about what they've said. And there's something to be said for the old idea of the smoke-filled room, you know, where people got out of the spotlight and just talked to each other and made negotiated things. And if we could do that with a kind of therapeutic sensitivities and pastoral sensitivities, I think it's a good thing.
I kind of hear you hearkening back to these notions, to the virtues of patience and slowness. And even if you dwell on hopes and fears, I mean, hopes and fears don't have quick fixes, right?
No.
I mean, if we let those into the room, then everything may take longer, although hopefully we actually get to a place where a common life benefits, right?
Yeah, the woman in the parking lot who gave me the finger.
Yeah.
And then she says to me when I approach her, if only you knew what kind of day I've had, you know? And she's telling me something there, and I don't have to hear her out on that. All I know is that was what I first thought was this terribly, you know, bold and angry person who was really attacking me was a hurting person.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say that's the answer to everything. You know, I'm not going to go to a Nazi and say, you know what, tell me about your hurts and the like. But for a good part of life, we're dealing with human beings just like ourselves. And it's so important to focus on and to be patient with each other, even if it's the patience of saying, I'm going to walk across this parking lot and talk to that person and just find out and just tell them I'm sorry.
So, you know, one thing that you're refusing to tell me that there's a thriving evangelical conversation just below the surface that's going to solve everything. But what you're pointing at is that some of these, maybe this rut we've gotten ourselves into public life or political life writ large, maybe there's not going to be some macro fix for that. But that creating safe places wherever we are, creating relationships wherever we are, it is the recourse we have to some of this public incivility.
And you know, I want to say, I see the seminary where I work and have a pretty influential leadership position in as that kind of safe place. And, you know, just before I started, you know, this conversation with you, I met with a member of our faculty who said to me, and it's very interesting as this happened today, you know, said to me, well, you know, following on your idea of convicted civility, and this idea has taken in our institutional culture.
The convicted civility. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really do think that for some reason we have been able to create a community that has taken this kind of thing as that's the kind of evangelicals we want to be. And people who aren't interested in that kind of evangelicalism probably not going to be very happy at Fuller Seminary. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just one way of thinking about where we can create safe spaces. But I've got to say, I've taken a lot. I don't mean to, you know, I'm no martyr and I haven't suffered. But, you know, I've taken a lot of flack for some of the things that I've done along these lines. But I think I haven't taken a lot of flack internally. I've taken a lot of flack from people outside. And I think our own community has been emboldened. And it's like the president is saying, hey, it's okay to be working on this. It's okay to be cultivating this kind of spirit. Mm-hmm. And so I do think, and again, I'm not setting myself up as an example, but I think if more people who have influence and leadership positions in other places of influence can kind of give their blessing to this and actually encourage it, I think this could be very important. I'm really quite apart from selling my books. I'm really encouraged by the fact that my book on civility is required reading in a lot of evangelical liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. There are a number of colleges that require it as the first book that freshmen read, you know, when they come in.
Interesting.
And so that, and there are other wonderful things like that. It's not just me. But to set the tone for, say, liberal arts education, for congregational life with these kinds of themes. Mm-hmm. I think there's hope for that.
One of the things you brought into your discussion in this updated, revised version of Uncommon Decency about Christian civility in an uncivil world between the late 80s and now, or early 1990 and now, is the notion of the encounter with Islam in American culture and, you know, globalization and the whole notion of how religious pluralism is so much more vast and so much more real and central. And I, you know, and it's a good place to talk about how the ground you're navigating, because, you know, you also write, say things like there are boundaries around Christian openness to be changed by others. So, I mean, there's a dance here. But I feel like you're taking up the fact that religious pluralism has become a matter for Christian theology.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, the danger is relativism, you know, that we not only live with the plurality of perspectives, but that somehow we navigate that plurality, that religious pluralism by saying, well, you know, we all have all views are of equal value. And on the other extreme, that we fight it, that we say, you know, there's only one. We've got the truth, and we can't tolerate alternatives. And somehow we've got to find our way between those and even see it as a God-given opportunity you know, to live out a different way of life. You know, it's very interesting that many of the people these days who are deeply concerned about the fact that there's a lot of pluralism from a religious perspective are sort of hostile to that idea. And they seem to think that Christianity flourishes where it's the kind of controlling monolithic definer of the ethos. And yet, I say to a lot of people, in my talks, You know, things are really bad today. I mean, they're so bad. You want to know how bad it is? It's as bad as the time of the New Testament. And that was the time in which Christianity went from a very small band of disciples to tremendous growth. And it was really sensing a pluralistic environment, a Christian community that saw itself as in a hostile environment. And yet that's the time when the growth of the church occurred. And I think we can take heart from the fact that in many ways we're living in a world now that is much like some of the best years of Christianity in the past.
I just want to keep you a couple more minutes, so I got a couple more questions. Just following on that, though, I know that I think you and I have talked before, and many of the conversations I have are about the paradox, in fact, of ecumenical and interfaith encounter, in that when real dialogue happens, and I know this is a quality in a lot of the dialogues you've been involved in, it's not an either or, right? Being changed by others, as you know, this line, there are boundaries around Christian openness to be changed by others, but that change is often not just a new understanding of the other, but a deepening of one's own virtues and convictions.
It's in the
category of mystery as much as it's in the category of meeting the stranger.
Yeah. Well, here's where I'd love to interview you, Krista, because things that I've heard about you and having followed your wonderful career in public radio with what you've done with just bringing these kinds of conversations into public radio. I sense that you're telling me your own story there.
Well,
at least the overall plot line.
No, huh? I do want to tell you a story, though, because I think it illustrates civility. I just think you'll like this story. I want to share it with you. I don't know if we'll put it on the air or not, but it's very moving to me. And in this category of that we have to create safe spaces wherever we are rather than wait for the system to change, I got this letter a couple years ago from a Southern Baptist minister in the Deep South who sent me a book he had written for children to introduce Islam, the religion of Islam. And he'd written this book because he was so distressed by the hatred that he saw, that he heard coming out of Christians about Muslims after September 11th. And he said, that is not a Christian response, that hatred. Now, I grew up Southern Baptist. And I haven't, you know, this pastor, his theology very well still tells him that Muslims are, you know, are not going to heaven, right? Or some verse, some way that he might say it that way. But I thought making that distinction, I mean, he can live with that theology, and that doesn't rule out this not just civil but very compassionate response of, you know, helping Christian children honor Muslims.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Boy, thank God for that. Huh? We need to look more people like that pastor too, because you know that his theology on heaven and hell and all the rest is probably not a lot different than mine. But you know, there's just such a strong tendency that if we can't count them in, if we can't say, well, we worship the same God and we're all going to the same place,
right.
Which you know, however else you nuance this. I think it's bad theology. That if you can't say that, then, you know, why should we be nicer to people than God is ultimately going to be nice to them, you know, with keeping them out of heaven and the like.
Right.
And I just think that we have to bracket those kinds of issues. And live with more mystery on that. You know, I did a thing on CNN a couple of years ago where they interviewed me for about an hour and a half on evangelicalism. They had a special that they did. And then when it came to, you know, I got on for a few minutes in the actual one-hour program that they ran. And they pitted me. You may not want to put this on the air either. But they paired me with a Southern Baptist, 8-year-old Southern Baptist homeschooled girl, And, you know, they went back and forth. I mean, I didn't meet her or anything. Yeah. But, and they would ask her a question, is Jesus the only way to heaven? And she would say, yes. And then they'd turn to me, you know, yeah. Is Jesus the only way to heaven? And I'd say, yes. And then they'd go back to her and says, well, what happens to all the people who don't believe in Jesus? And she's with a big grin on her face. This poor kid, but big grin on her face. She says, they go to hell. And then they turned to me, you know, and I said, you know, I don't believe everybody's going to get in, but I live with a lot of mystery on how Jesus actually gets a hold of people. And, you know, that's the way I've got to leave it. And I'm just not going to make those kinds of judgments. I mean, mm-hmm. if you really and is that a lack of conviction? Heck no. I mean, yeah. if you really believe that God alone can judge the human heart and that God alone will decide the eternal destiny of people, then we are not in the business of deciding that somebody there is not going to make it, you know.
Yeah.
And we just need to – but even that – even reasoning that way isn't the right way to go, because the fact is that God did create that person. That person is a valued work of divine art. And quite apart from eternal destiny and all the rest, we need to treat that person with the dignity that they deserve as creatures of God.
You know, in the context of talking about civility, you decry the kind of Christian triumphalism that colors the way Christians sometimes deal with people in our public life. But you use the language of Christ's cosmic lordship. So I wonder how you would describe. Now, that might sound alarming to someone, too, but how does that make a difference for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, Christ is the Lord of all things. One of my favorite theologians, actually my theological hero, the great Dutch theologian who was also prime minister of the Netherlands for a while in the 19th century, Abraham Kuyper said, there's not one square inch of the entire creation about which Jesus Christ does not cry out, this is mine, this belongs to me. And I like that. But it's also dangerous because
it sounds scary to a lot of people.
Yeah, it all belongs to Jesus. Let's go out and conquer those square inches for Jesus. And, you know, that's the Crusades.
Right.
Let's take the territory back for Jesus. And what I would rather say is that if he is the one who rules over all of the square inches of creation, then those Muslim women who are so oppressed by governments that stone women to death for what are, for many of us, very minor issues, that Jesus grieves with them, that Jesus is there with them, that Jesus grieves with those who are victims of racism and economic injustice and all the rest, so that we need to see his cosmic lordship as the one who calls us to go out to all areas of reality and identify with the things that he deeply cares about. And that means that we identify with suffering, that we identify with the desecration of the natural order and many, many other things. So I would rather take that idea of cosmic lordship as a call to a God who rules, from a God who rules over everything, for us to go out and do his will and identify with the things that that God identifies with. And a lot of that is just suffering people.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to say? Anything else you want
to
say?
No, gee.
Okay, sorry, I took you through the ringer. But you know what we do now is
great.
We put the unedited interview out, and there are a lot of people who will just listen to this whole hour and a half.
Yeah.
And then we turn it into the radio show, and we will we'll let you know all the details when this is happening, and I think if we can send you questions by email if there's anything that comes up. But
sure.
So great to talk to you, and I hope to see you in person again one of these days, too.
Yeah, hey, you're terrific. I really appreciate this, and it's been enjoyable.
Thank you. Yeah, it has. Hey. And it's important. It's such an important subject.
Yeah. Well, you You're good. You raise good questions. You keep the conversation going. So.
Thank you. Right.
Strength to you.
You take care.
Yeah,
right.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, SCPR.